Morning, members, ladies and gentlemen. Just want to welcome you for this for the committee meeting that's going to be considering two presentations today on the strat plans of the Industrial Development Commission and also Cooperation and the Competition Commission. I'm happy that both entities are here with us. That would yes, I was saying I'm quite happy that both entities are here after the postponement of the meeting last week. We really appreciate the fact that you could still attend our meeting. And I think it also gave an opportunity for members to go through the documents thoroughly with an intention of positively, not in a negative way, interrogate the work of the two entities. We have a responsibility as the committee to oversee the work of all our entities, and in so doing is after understanding that they are in a better position or they are better conduits of servicing our people than ourselves as government, because they apply both public and private techniques, private sector techniques to in implementing. So hence the fast tracking from their side. And therefore, it is important that when we look at their work, we look at them with that eye. Copies have been circulated after being tabled. There was a circulated to all members, and then there is also a copy of the analysis of the two entities from our researchers circulated to our members. If not, I think it's on its way from the secretary of the committee's office. We're hoping to finish today's work at 1, and in so doing I'm going to be a bit stricter on time, because I know that members had a very long weekend, especially members from my party. We've been busy ever since we have interested, so, and we're still going to be busy for the rest of the week. So I will not waste any further time, but then hand over to the secretary to give us apologies, if there are any apologies.
Good morning, honorable members. I've got 4 apologies. The first one is from Honorable Van der Merwe. She apologized that she won't be able to attend the meeting due to a prior engagement with the Committee of Trade and Industry. The second one is from Honorable Ngonyama. He apologized due to the fact that he will be in Gauteng this week. The other one is from Honorable Sai. He has a commitment in his constituency. And the last one is from Honorable Krumbo. They are having a congress in his province this week.
I thought the Congress is done. let's, in the same breath, then congratulate Mr. Hussein for his election as the chairman of the DA KwaZulu-Natal province. We hope you prepare for the challenge from the ANC still coming. We'll meet on the playing field. Anyway, thank you very much. Congratulations and all the best in your work. I know that Mr. Ngonyama spoke to me personally. I don't know whether why is it not reflected in his apology. He actually apologized to myself and the whip that he is not well. He will be admitted in Joburg somewhere this week. I don't know starting from when. So that was the apology. Just I wanted to finish it off because last week it was indicating such. This week is not. Okay. Mr. Mubo?
Chair, I just wanted to find out, I believe there was supposed to have been a committee meeting on Friday, and some of us were not informed. I didn't get any notice to that effect.
I did speak to the... I realized when we were here, I did speak to the secretary, and she really apologized, but she's indicated that they have circulated invitations. I don't know how she did that, but... between her and the committee assistant, but I realized that there are members who definitely didn't know. While there were those who have apologized, but there are some who didn't know about the meeting. Apologies from our side, Mr. Mubu. Now that we all in one, may we proceed? Thank you very much. May I then hand over to all? Mr. Klina and the delegation, mostly welcome. I know the last time you met with us, we were configured in another way. This time, you know, the ANC part is only added one member. We have Ms. Mohorose who joined us now recently. And then from the DA, we have Mr. Hussein, as I have already congratulated him, and then we have Mr. Mubu from ID. We have Mr. Krumbuk from DA, and they were contesting each other, and then the other one lost. Maybe that's why he's not here. He's still suffering the loss. That was on a lighter note. Yeah, otherwise also the UDM is no longer part of us because of commitments in other committees. For the purposes or for the sake of those members who are new, I would request that you also introduce your delegation. I understand there's also person from ESCOM. We have the PMG from Parliament. Ma'am, may you introduce yourself so that we know who's here?
Good morning, Chair. Thank you. I'm Karen de Villiers from ESCOM.
Okay. Thank you very much for attendance, for showing interest in the business of the committee. We also have the media present here with us, PMG. Can you introduce yourself quickly?
Zaida Adams, PNG.
Okay. Thank you, Zaida.
Hi, Chair. It's Comunita Dudley from Telkom.
Oh, okay. Thank you for gracing us.
Hello, I'm Carol Pageant from the Business Day.
Thank you, Carol.
Donnie de Villiers from Cecil.
Oh, thank you, Mr. de Villiers, also. That's it. May we hand over to you, Mr. Klina? not introduce our... I think the researcher was there. Sorry about that. Our researcher, Nabisa Belekan, who has been there, I think you know her. Our new secretary is Unoluthando Skaka, who has joined the committee. Yes, that is all from our side. Hand over to you.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the honourable members as well of the portfolio committee for inviting us to come and share with you our strategic plan for the financial year that's coming. My name is Jeffrey Klina. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the IDC. On my extreme, on my immediate left is Shakil Mir. Shakil is the Executive in Charge of Strategy and Portfolio Management at the IDC. In fact, he will be the one who will be doing the detailed presentation today to the committee. And next to Shakil Mir, we have Lebu Budibe. Lebu is the manager in my office. And next to Lebu, Saul, I'm sure you can introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Saul Levine. I'm from the Economic Development Department. I'm working with the Development Finance Institutions. I have an apology from the Acting Director General who's unable to make it.
Thanks, Saul. And once more, thank you, Chair. I think behind the Competition Commission team will introduce themselves when it's their turn to present. Chair, every time we are invited by the Portfolio Committee to come and share with yourselves, be it in terms of the plans or in terms of the results, it's an opportunity we always welcome because this is also a time for us to learn and understand through the Portfolio Committee what South Africa needs, as we are an institution of government tasked to help serve and stimulate the economy of South Africa. So we always welcome this, and the inputs that we get here, we do indeed take them seriously. Chair, today what we are going to present is our plan for the next financial year. Our financial year starts from the 1st of April, like all other government entities. Although in the detailed document that we have in terms of the numbers, you will see we do have a five-year plan. So in that five-year plan, because every year we have what we call a rolling five-year plan, so we look at the projects, because most of the activities that we do as IDC have a long-term effect, and hence it's important that we have this rolling five-year, which we will update from time to time. So the document that we have, you'll see it's a five-year plan. Today we are not going to report on the performance, because we know that there will be an opportunity to come to the committee again later in the year to come and share how we've done. Our year ends this month. So it's only about a week. So once those numbers have been audited, we will be able to then engage and share with the committee when the time has been set. Also, this year we've been the financial year that is almost coming to an end. Since the president, during his State of the Nation, the president of the country during State of the Nation address last year, when he announced the merger of Kula and SAMAF into IDC Small Business to form and establish a new unit. That work has been done. I'm sure Saul at an appropriate time will talk to that. We are not, in terms of the plan that we have, it does not in any greater detail cover that part. What you see is in the detailed plan, we have a line where we've shown how much we've committed over the next 5 years in terms of the funding, which is about 1.4, but we're not going to talk about that, because once the business plan has been finalized, that will be separately tabled, and I would want to think, Chair, that will be the last time it's separately tabled. After, in the next financial year, we'll just have one the presentation, because that will be part of the IDC group. It's because we are still finalizing that. Now, with that as a background, Chair, if we look in terms of our vision and our mission and our objectives, those for the period, those have not changed. as the IDC, we still see IDC being a primary driving force for industrial development, sustainable industrial development. Even the outputs, and the outcomes rather, we still feel that they are still very relevant, particularly in this time where we have to increase our level of activity. Our values have stayed the same. Our pillars in terms of the strategy have stayed the same. The presentation today, Chair, what it does is really emphasizes the point that as IDC we need to continue to do more, and hence when Shakil presents, we will try and show that the level of activity we're looking at increasing it in that even more than the previous year, because we do understand that we're operating in times where really the level of activity needs to be a bit higher than before. And also in the plan, what we're showing is that we more and more being catalytic in terms of starting new initiatives rather than just to wait for people to come to the IDC for funding. So that will still happen, where people will come to the IDC for funding, but there's more and more commitment from our side that we need to start new projects. And we will continue as well, Chair, that we work in partnership with other players. I think it's very important because we need to find clever ways of crowding in the private sector as well, so that we can tap into their resources. Because as we still continue, we're still self-funding as the IDC, and we have to ensure that then even the projects that we do fund are sustainable in their own nature. So at this point, let me allow Shaki just to take the committee through the slides that we have shared. I hope every member has a copy of the slide. We did try and circulate those in addition to the document that is that was tabled earlier.
Thank you, Chair. As the CEO mentioned, we follow a five-year strategy, and the key pillars have remained the same because we did a full review of our plan in the previous financial year, and we're now approaching the end of the first year of implementation of the five-year strategy. And the main pillar, in a sense, is industrial development, because that is our core objective, to make sure that we are implementing the policies in terms of areas like industrial policy, the new growth path, and so on. And a lot of our focus in there is in making sure that we are more proactive in trying to drive the key things that need to be done to benefit the country, as well as identify key sectors, develop strategies, and drive those. Together with that, the second pillar talks to how we need to cooperate with government, we need to cooperate with other DFIs to make sure that we work together to have the maximum possible impact and remove as many constraints as possible. The last two pillars talk to how we deliver on that. So firstly, we want to make sure that we use the funds available, that we use our people to the maximum possible, that we raise funds as cheaply as possible. We're going to need to invest, since we're planning to invest a lot more in the economy, we need to raise more funds. But we need to make sure we don't take our eye off the ball and, in fact, improve on our customer service while doing that. In particular, one of the focus areas around customer service is our turnaround times. We're paying a lot of attention to trying to see that we deliver as quickly as possible. The last element of our strategy is talking about green, where we as an organization want to be greener, but we also want to support our clients and the rest of industry to have a more positive impact on the environment. If we look at the main areas that we've allocated funds for, in terms of the total amount that we're budgeting to invest, we're looking at a minimum of 15 billion rand in new approvals for the coming financial year. To put that in context, we're still going to report on this current financial year, but in the year before this, we approved just over 8 billion rand. So we're looking at close to doubling our level of investments from where we were in the last financial year. In this current financial year, we will report later, but we are expecting a growth from that 8 billion rand. To just highlight some of the main sectors that we are allocating significant funds to, the strategic high impact projects, that's getting a significant allocation, and that's largely driven by the focus on infrastructure within the country and our role in terms of industrial infrastructure within that. And secondly, we're looking at trying to localize manufacturing increasingly, and I'll talk in a little more detail about some of those. One of the main focuses of our new strategy is green industry, and that's getting the largest allocation in this current financial year. In terms of mining, a big part of our focus at the moment is in terms of trying to look at the steel value chain to see if we can reduce the price of steel downstream so it can help strengthen our manufacturing base. To remind the committee of our funding model, we are self-funding, but our funds are raised as our investments mature. We exit when we want to invest in new equities. We need to borrow to invest in loan funding, and we make income through our dividend holdings primarily. From our loan, we receive interest, but then we pay over interest on the funds we borrow. There is a large element of cross-subsidization within our portfolio. That's partly because we do some things which are fairly early stage in some of our loans, which have a fairly low return. But also it's a timing issue, because once we make an investment, it takes some time before we can generate dividends out of a new investment. A key element of our focus is to say that we want to increasingly fund startups and expansions. And that type of focus involves a relatively higher risk profile if you compare with a typical bank, because we are funding new projects, we are funding people without a strong track record very often in that particular business. There's often limited security. For the last 2 or 3 years, distress funding has become significant at 12%, and that's particularly a feature of the economic crisis. For the balance of the presentation, I'll highlight some of the key strategies that we're aiming to implement in different sectors. IDC is not an agricultural organization. We focus on industrial development, with the land bank focusing more on the agriculture. But we need to play a role in terms of assisting with rural development. And where we see a major role for ourselves going forward is in the agro-processing sector. If we can create a strong value chain demand from the agricultural sector so that there is a reliable market for emerging farmers and other farmers, and that there is an increasing value add. And a good example of that is something that we have been looking at is a dairy in a rural area in the Eastern Cape, where we're looking at funding a dairy which will then source the milk from a number of emerging farmers in the area. Together with the rural impact, there's a major opportunity for agro-industries to have a big impact on our export balance. There's a number of agricultural products which we are currently importing, even though we have got agricultural land, we have got expertise. So we are focusing on trying to identify some of those key products, and examples are malt and edible oils, so that we can create strong local malt processing, soya processing industries, and reduce the level of imports, but at the same time having the impact on rural areas that I spoke about. One of the focus areas as presented by the state president in the State of the Nation address is infrastructure. IDC is not a core infrastructure DFI, but we have a key role to play in terms of this. We are working very closely with the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission in terms of the rollout plans, and we will make investments in infrastructure where it's directly related to industrial projects and is needed as part of the projects. But over and above that, we've got a key role to play, and I'm glad to see that some of our fellow parastatals are here as well, because a very important role we need to play in the infrastructure development is to make sure that when these are rolled out, we supply locally as much as possible rather than importing all our products. so that we get the maximum benefit out of the money that we are spending. And we create the jobs in the manufacturing as a result of those areas. An example of something that we have been working on is rolling stock to make sure that that is funded and developed locally as much as possible. The committee would be aware that there has been a strong thrust from governments, in particular led by the DTI, with Treasury and Economic Development, in terms of looking at our procurement approach. We see our role as supporting the procurement approach, and one of the particular focus areas that we are trying to develop a project is trying to make sure there's sufficient capacity to locally manufacture buses, taxis, and trucks. In terms of the Preferential Procurement Policy Act and in terms of the work that has been done by the DCI, they've identified, for example, that the bus industry is something which has major potential, with the metros in particular buying a number of buses. What we have seen in the past is that most of those have been imported, and we'd like to develop the local capacity to supply as much as possible into these demands. We spoke in the previous year about green industries being a major thrust, and you'll see, and as I showed in the earlier slide, this is the second biggest area that we are allocating funds for this year. In terms of the current Independent Power Producers Program, we participated in both the first and second rounds. In terms of the first round of bidding, the projects that we've supported, a number of them have been given preferred status, and we are looking at funding wind, solar, and concentrated solar projects, largely in the Northern Cape, Western Cape, Eastern Cape, and Northwest. One of the pleasing aspects of the IPP process is that a lot of these projects are almost by definition going into the less developed areas. We have participated in the second round, and we are waiting to hear the results of those tenders. In terms of energy efficiency, we don't want to look at just the generation side. We want to make sure that companies work more efficiently because we are aware of the challenges on our national grid and our electricity generation. But also in terms of the prices that have been going up for electricity, we need to make sure that companies remain competitive. If they can operate efficiently, they can actually reduce their costs, and they will be more competitive going forward. So there's a very strong push, and in fact we launched a fund during the course of the current year, and we'll talk more about it when we present the results, and in terms of supporting companies with energy efficiency. One of the challenges that we are facing as a country is large rural areas are relatively underdeveloped. There are a number of community-controlled land areas. Together with that, we've got an expected shortage of timber going forward. We've decided to take a proactive role to work together with the communities, and in fact, we are actually supporting them from the beginning of generating a plan, of putting a plan together, so that we can develop projects in forestry, and where possible, identify markets and the expertise to assist the companies. We've, in fact, made funds available. We've been working closely with other government departments. We've been assigned project managers to work with the communities. And, in fact, the first project, in fact, has been approved in that respect. In terms of clothing and textiles, we're all aware of the challenges around the industry. We've been working very closely with the DTI and the sector in terms of rolling out a program to make companies in the sector more competitive. So together with our funding, and we also manage some grant money on behalf of the DTI, we are supporting companies to invest in making their processes more competitive through equipment and through process improvements. One of the areas that we're looking going forward is in terms of closer Southern Africa integration, in terms of our Africa strategy, and in terms of clothing and textiles in particular, in the coming year. That's an area where we'd like to identify opportunities where we can look at the relative strengths of South Africa, maybe Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Swaziland, and see if we can build a regional value chain so that we can become world competitive through leveraging of the strengths within the region. One of the other focus areas is the healthcare sector. And in particular with NHI being planned, we want to make sure that as much as possible we have security of supply for local pharmaceutical ingredients and medical devices. Currently, a lot of our production of medicines tends to be relatively downstream. We want to increasingly encourage more production of active ingredients. And one of the first projects that we're working with, together with a Swiss company and Nexa, is to look at antiretroviral active ingredient production. So this is still relatively early stage, the intention within the course of this coming year to actually see if we can develop a project, which then would get funded in future periods. Maybe at this stage, just to highlight, we spoke about being proactive. This is the type of example where we identify something upfront, we identify partners, we work with them. The actual investment might happen 2 or 3 years down the line if we can successfully have this type of develop this type of projects. I touched on the downstream metal industry and the steel in particular. We want to try and encourage more competition in the steel industry. One of the challenges that the downstream manufacturers have experienced is the relatively high cost of steel, and we want to see how we can play a role through multiple strategies. We're exploring new steel mills, mini mills, looking at recycling scrap and so on, so that there is competition and so that the prices overall reduce, and at the more labor-intensive downstream areas, we can create more jobs. Finally, over the last 3 years, each time we've been talking to this committee, we first mentioned to the committee we're planning on rolling out regional offices in every province, and we did that. The next step was to roll out branch offices, and we have rolled out some, but during the course of this year, we're going to roll out an additional one in Upington. A relatively new concept is we're rolling out satellite offices, where we are visiting different areas. And what we want to increasingly do going forward as the new merged small business entity works, look at how we can cooperate in terms of location of the different offices. Thank you.
Thanks, Shakil. Chair, what we have in the corporate plan in the document, what we don't show here is the financial standing, that is the balance sheet, the income statement, the borrowing program of the IDC. Those are detailed in from page 22. Maybe just a point just to make, Chair, if we look in the first scenario, over 5 years, we're looking at approving about 88 billion, which is also still an increase compared to the last plan that we had the previous financial year when we looking at the 5 year. However, if we have to look at on a higher scenario where the constraints are removed, where the economic conditions are better improved, we have an ability of increasing over the 5 year, the same 5 year period, our level of approvals to about 111 billion. But that's dependent on a number of other factors which will need to be removed before that. The impact of that, Chair, is if we look on the normal business scenario, that IDC would still continue to be sustainable, even increasing those levels of investments to that 88 billion. Only when we go on a higher scenario where although still strong, but we'll see the profitability reducing a bit. I mean, mainly the big reason being because we're starting new projects, more of the new projects, they will take time before they start generating income. And at the same time, we would need to divest more or sell some of our investments to be able to invest there so that income a substitution will take a little bit longer than it was. But where we are in terms of the plan, Chair, we think as management, and this, because it's also been approved by the board of the IDC, that this is a plan that can be implemented and that is sustainable. Naturally, we do admit that we will still rely on what the external factors are outside as well, which have a bearing or at least an influence on the level and the speed of the investments. But from the IDC, in terms of what the board has approved, be it in terms of the budget and also the resources in terms of people that we have, I think we have the skills and we have the people and we have the support from the shareholder to can be able to implement this plan that we're presenting to you as a committee. Thank you. I'm not sure, Saul, do you want to say something? So that's the end. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Saul is an overseer. No, I don't want you to add. If you don't have anything to say, I'm just giving you an opportunity so that you don't say we didn't. Actually, we're meeting with you on Thursday, don't worry. That's where we'll be asking you a lot of questions. Okay. Thank you very much for the presentation. Quite promising, and talking to the pronouncements made by the President and the Minister in various forums. Can we, members, engage on the presentation, please? I've noted Member Hussein, Member Ntuli, any other? Okay, members are still digesting what you just presented to them. Thank you. Stilson?
Chair, thank you very much. Just two or three very quick and short questions. The first one is, can you perhaps speak around the focus areas in the textile industry and to what extent is IDC making investments in that industry to resuscitate it? And just expand on that particular industry. The impression that I'm getting, and I might very well be incorrect, is that IDC is on the receiving end of requests as opposed to taking proactive measures of actually trying to resuscitate that industry, and I might very well be wrong if you could speak to that. And then do you have any available data on some failed initiatives that you would have made investments in, and the startups more especially, considering the high risk that is involved in that? Perhaps either in numbers or percentages of your funds that could have been lost through that. You talked about energy efficiency initiatives and where you're assisting businesses to try and reduce their or to better their energy efficiency. I'm just trying to understand the link between and while at the same time appreciating that I think that it's the right thing to do. But I'm trying to understand the link that you make between your core business as IDC and reducing energy efficiency. Are you doing this with companies that you fund only, or is it in general? Because in my mind, I would think that that's possibly more Eskom's role than yours, but if you would explain. The last one is the decrease in the distribution to the mining and beneficiation sector, which has dropped from 31% to 17%, and if you could just perhaps maybe just expand on the reasons why that that there is that decrease, one would expect that they it should have been the other way around. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks a lot, Member Ntuli.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson, and I would like to welcome the presentation. Chairperson, I want to check. We can see that IDC is participating in many ways in creating a growth of the economy. I want to check whether the growth goes in hand with the jobs creation, or say the labor intensive check the fund whether we can be able to quantify that. If we can, how many jobs we are looking at, particularly this financial year? Do we have, value for money? Number two is to check the previous where IDC was helping, let's say, this the distressed companies. How many, or have we done any impact on that one, like that training layoff scheme? Have we encountered any problems, particularly when we were doing the oversight? We found that some of the companies were not aware, particularly those who do not have the organized labor. They were not aware of the scheme, the training layoff scheme. So I want to check that one, if you can take us through. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you. Babuntuli, Metsotese.
Thank you, Chairperson. Under agro industries, the replacement of imported products, I think the focus here is to a large extent make life better for consumers out there at the end of the day. I would like to know, how would you deal with the situation whereby imported products come with predatory prices? And because consumers, they really don't care a lot about their local slackers. They don't know those politics. They're just focusing on prices. And moving forward, the challenge is coming with Walmart, whereby they have this history of soloing small businesses. How are you going to deal with such challenges in order to promote local business? Thank you.
Thanks, Ma'am Sotetsi. Ntate Mubu.
Thank you, Chair. Reading through your document on page 1, the document, there's a paragraph that says that the ITC has not received capital injection from its shareholders since the 1950s. When you look at some of the state entities that from time to time have to go to government to get some bailouts, that sounds like a very good record. I mean, what would be the major strength of the IDC that you've been able to sustain yourself for so long without a major financial injection from your shareholders? Secondly, on page 8, you're talking about regional industrial integration. And that you're looking to the rest of Africa, particularly in the region, SADC region, in terms of financing major projects there. You're talking about Mozambique, for example, the aluminium smelter there. In the case of a country like Zimbabwe, where some of our companies that are invested, they have been pressurized into ceding certain percentage of their shares to the localization program, do you see this as a threat to IDC financial assistance to companies that operate in countries like Zimbabwe? I think that's it for now, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Mabasa.
Oh, sorry.
Sounds like there's a challenge, problem with your mic.
No, I was saying thanks for the input from the team led by Mr. Gina. Thanks, Comrade Chair. I just want to ask one question. This question is based on what we notice. For a very long time, we have been noticing that to close the gap between the rich and the poor. It's a struggle that we will not win except if government goes all out to fulfill that obligation. But secondly, cooperatives are taken as small entities that just need 1,000 rand, 2,000 rands. Most departments never think of cooperatives as entities that could need or warrant millions. So I want to ask whether there are any cooperatives that IDC has assisted, and also roughly the amount, because that the amount will also indicate where we place them. Do we think they just belong down there, or do we think they deserve to stand with other big business? Thanks.
Dr. Mabasa, any other? Thank you, Babu Krina. From my side, I just want to understand, I want you to elaborate further, actually, on the issue that you're raising on page 12 of your stretch plan. I think you're talking to that is under investment budgets. I just want you to explain it to the layman's, using the layman's language, so that we can understand what you mean when you say if you push yourself enough and to implement your strategies, you can expect to finance 88 billion. I mean, to me, it's a hanging statement. It doesn't really give me concrete commitment that this is what you will be doing over the next 5 years. And I think there's a commitment from government. And because I need you to perhaps indicate to us what are the challenges you might be facing that might, or the threats that you think might hinder you from achieving such. And moreover, that you indicating opportunities, on page 12, on figure 5. From historically, you indicate where you were, how you performed, and then going forward, you just give us opportunities and where you are currently if you operate under normal, where you can be if you operate under normal circumstances. So I want you to open up to the committee, you know, and tell us the story so that we can understand it the way you understand it. Thank you. That would be my first question for now. I'm still coming.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the questions from the members. I think some of these questions will make this room to be very hot for us. Let's start with your question, and then we'll come back, because I think it provides a very good basis for us to respond to the others. I think it's probably the language. I think the commitment, Chair, is that over the next 5 years, we're committing to invest 88 billion. The 111 billion, we're saying, if certain constraints and the economic climate changes, and there are some of the projects that we know where the probability is a bit low for them to happen, might be higher, then we can increase to 111. So there's a commitment. I think that's let me just clear it. I think it's probably the English that we use which might create some doubt. In terms of the plans that we have, 88 billion is what we have, and I think that's what the board has approved, and that's what the shareholder is under the
understanding that's that. The figure five, Chair, which is very irrelevant, maybe to further strengthen the point, is that if you look at the first 5 years, those yellow bars, those are historical performance. It shows how we've performed in terms of the approvals. As Shakil said, in 2010, 2011, we had approved about 8 billion or so. And for this year, which is almost coming to an end now, in 2 weeks' time, 2011, 2012, we're estimating at about 13 billion, I think. But we'll finalize the numbers. So when we report, when we come back to the committee, we will be reporting on those numbers. So what this plan is showing going forward is that we're looking at increasing those numbers, Chair. If you can see, I mean, from that, it's really, I mean, going up on an upward trend. So that's a further commitment to say we want to increase the level of investment. So if you look at 2012, 2013, and compared to 2010, 2011, we're almost doubling what we want to do. The red ones then talk to us, how can we move to 111? So there's a commitment, Chair. I think maybe the language is not that clear, but there's a commitment for us to do a bit more.
Opportunity, sorry, to come back before you finish all questions. Just explain the opportunity. You say if you, for instance, remove the constraints, what are those constraints? We are in a committee. We want to understand so that we can be able. Because if there is that potential of going that far, what are those constraints perhaps that might hinder you not achieving your or utilizing all the opportunities that
Thanks, Chair. The points we make, I think we also made in the last presentation to the committee. I think some of them would be issues of environmental. Some of them would be just the economic climate, because remember, we have a lot of companies which would fund, which would export their products. So if we look in Europe and in the US, where they would be exporting, if those markets don't improve, it makes it a little bit more of a challenge for them to increase, at least increase the level of production so that they can do that. That's one part. But also, as we address, which is why I think when we showed, when Shakil showed the presentation, which is why we're working with the Portfolio in Infrastructure Commission, is to look in how we help unlock or improve the infrastructure so that then some of these opportunities can happen. So once the infrastructure, because those are long-term projects, so once the infrastructure is in place, then it becomes easier to then to increase the capacity as well. So those are the ones. In fact, let me hasten to say, Chair, since we've highlighted some of these constraints, we've engaged with economic development, being the department itself, and we've seen some improvement. For an example, in the issues of water licenses and all of that, we've seen in some of the projects which we'd had, which had relied on that, where they've been delayed in the past, and we've seen really an improvement. So we do engage with the department, and the department does assist in that regard. So the bottom line is, Chair, we committed to the 88, and I think we can go to 111 if all some of those factors are in place. Maybe let's go back to the questions then, Chair, by the other members. There's a question on the textile industry. Are we being proactive or are we being reactive? We're being both as IDC. We're being proactive. But also we found some of the companies, particularly when we started this distress funding, where they've experienced difficulties, they've come to the IDC. So we have a couple of them. In fact, when we report on the results, you'll see some of them where we can identify them. Because some of them, if IDC did not come into the picture, we would find that those jobs would have been lost. So naturally, the two provinces that have benefited mostly is KwaZulu-Natal and the Western Cape, because that's where you find most of those the textile industries. So we've also been proactive in that some of the companies that we've seen, either through the interaction that we've had investments in them as IDC, but because our sector knows what's happening in those, we've approached them to say what could be done to ensure that they're sustainable. So I think that is important. However, what let me hasten to say is when we look at a situation. I think what is important, it will talk to a point that has been asked on how are we sustainable. We need to be convinced that the solution that we will provide will be a sustainable one. Because if it's not sustainable, we will continue to put in money into those companies, and then you'd find that they are never sustainable. So we try and find a sustainable solution. The partnership that we have with the Department of Trade and Industry has helped in that. Then they provide a grant and a grant portion in some cases, just to look at their processes. Because what we found is some of those companies, the reason why they're not competitive is maybe that their layout, just a simple thing as their layout or how they handle the material and all of that, just makes them not competitive, and it increases the cost. That's probably one part. But then what we've also seen is some of them have old equipment, and then hence we look at the competitiveness one, where we put in investing money side by side with Trading Industries Grant, where we put them in the modernization of the equipment. So that, those are some of our interventions that we have. What we will do, Chair, we can either do it at the next one or we can do it in between. We can provide some data to the portfolio members in terms of how many startups we've done and all of that we can do. There are some, we have, for an example, one case which comes to mind where the company which we've owned over time, where the raw material was imported, for an example, it's in the textile industry. But now what we're doing is we're putting in a project to actually plant the raw material in South Africa to do test trials and see what you can do. But you can only do that if you have the ability to take a long-term approach. So that means then in the interim, we have to find means of ensuring that the business is sustainable. I mean, one of them is here in the Western Cape where we're assisting them. Because we are conscious that the textile industry is a difficult one. There's lots of competition. But we're also conscious that there's a lot of employment in here, so we have to find creative ways of ensuring that we sustain it. It's not an easy one. That is why when we're looking at the regional integration as well, we're trying to see maybe where is it best place for us to get the raw material within the region. For an example, I'll give you an example. If we think cotton would be better in some of the SADC countries, then let's say maybe let's encourage the planting of the cotton there, but let's maybe look at the processing of that. Those are some of the strategies that we're looking at to ensure that we help the textile industry. But in addition to that, what the teams have been doing, have been talking to the retailers, because I think that will also talk to the question that has been asked by Mam Tsotet, to say the consumer does not sometimes feel passionate about local as liquor. But now the best way is for us to talk to the retailers to say, what is it that you're procuring outside of South Africa? And then let's find ways of actually maybe producing it here locally. So we need them to come to the party. In the textile industry, I think there's been good progress. There's still lots of imports, we know that, but there's been good progress. I mean, where we've seen a number of these big retailers really coming to the party and engaging with us to say how we can really increase the level of production within South Africa. Also, there's an element of policing. I mean, where in the past 2 to 3 years was a major problem, where illegal imports and all of that. I mean, IDC, was proactive, engaging with the Department of Trade and Industry, talking to SARS as well to try and clamp down. And now we've seen really some of that happening, where people have under-declared when they've imported and all of it. But that has also undermined really the industry itself. So I think that's what we try and do in the textile industry. In terms of our intervention on the green energy, Chair, we do that as part of our funding. I think in one of the slides the Shakil showed what we do it in partnership. So we would say we know as we invest in some of these major projects, they have, in fact, by their nature, they consume a lot of energy. So let's find better ways of reducing that. So as we do this, we understand, we do work with Eskom in terms of some of the interventions they have, but we're saying over and above that, what can we do? Which is why we had this. We engaged with KfW for a while, where they've brought in a facility where it's a concessionary one, together with them, where we we made it available to companies who can reduce their energy use. So normally you'd find that those are the big companies, because we know not only is it a cost for them in their production, but it also would help, I think, Eskom in the long term in terms of that they can redirect that energy. So we do it on two-pronged approach, really. If you look at the mining, percentage-wise, it looks like a decrease. It's not a decrease. Value-wise, absolutely, it's not on the absolute numbers. But the reason why it looks like a decrease is because we're doing more on the other sectors as well. So relative to what they would normally have been allocated as a percentage, that looks a bit low. Where we've seen one growth area is the green economy space, where we're putting in a bit more than before, because it's also a new industry for us. So that's one of the big beneficiaries. I mean, Shakil did mention that in the first round, almost about 5 billion has been approved into the green, be it wind or solar or PV, the combination. And this year, we're participating on the second round. We'll see what that means. So we'll see proportionately as a percentage. But if you look at the portfolio, still you'll find that mining will still be the big one. There's a question on the growth, whether this growth is indeed reflecting the labor intensity and are we getting value for money. Chair, it's something that we always try and ensure that we do indeed get value for money. We know even in the President's State of the Nation last year and even this year, the issue of jobs is still something that needs to be addressed, which is why then we also come up with some interventions to try and stimulate job creation. That's why we have this 10 billion rands, which was approved last year to assist companies that can be able to create jobs at a cost of less than 500,000, half a million, where they can access it at Prime Ministry. That's one intervention. And that's why we've also engaged with the Unemployment Insurance Fund to access cheaper money so that we can pass it through at 6% fixed over 5 years to ensure that we encourage job creation. However, we know in some sectors, those would not be as labor intensive as it wants them to be if you look at them directly, but they have an effect indirectly of creating jobs. For an example, if you look into the green energy space that we're coming in, it's a new one. If you look directly, the jobs that have been created are very limited, but if you look at the components, manufacturing, where we're trying to increase the local portion, that we'll be able to create it. So it's something that we always try and say, are we getting value for money? But we do accept that in certain sectors, we will not be able to achieve that. I think in terms of our plans, Shakil will correct me, I think we're planning for this year to, at least from the approvals that we have, we should be able to create about 30,000 jobs, we hope, from these approvals. So obviously, these are the direct ones. We're not counting the indirect ones. Okay. Yeah. So we're not counting the indirect ones, which ordinarily you could, because once we have a plant here, then there'll be others that will come in. But if we found it, it's easier and it's just cleaner that we do that. The distressed companies, the impact, Chair, we had approved about 6 billion, I think about 3 years ago now. Yes, about 3 years ago. And we're still left with about a billion, I think we just, about 1.3 exactly that we're still left with, which is still available for companies in distress. We have tried to do road shows, talk about it, because we thought in the first round the slow uptake was because people did not know. But last year, I mean, I spent a lot of time just traveling South Africa, talking to people about what IDC does and what products we have. And as Shakil has showed in the slide, where we have increased the number of satellite offices and other offices, really to engage with people so that they can make use of the facility to assist them where they are. I don't think we've touched each and every corner of South Africa. I did realize that, but we will continue to try and make sure, Chair, that we publicize and we engage with people as much as we can. Even, I mean, that's the message to some of the offices that we have. It has been in some cases where we have engaged with business on and making them aware of the training layoff scheme. But I can't sit here and say we've done it at each and every opportunity. So, but we have, it's something that we have. When we're looking at a solution, we have brought it and made at least those parties aware of that. Shakil will talk about agro industries and Walmart. No, Shakil, can you just respond?
Maybe there was just one other question which you missed in terms of failed investments. Our impairment levels overall are about close to 17% currently, which is relatively high, but that's a reflection of the high risk profile we take, and it's been growing during the economic crisis. Now, I must say that that doesn't equate to 17% of failed projects, because what we do when we run into a problem, we impair it, but then we work with the company to try and find a way to turn it around. So a lot of that does get written back over time. In terms of agro-industries, our first choice in terms of the projects that we're choosing are things which are not going to require import duties. So the intention is not to try to push up the prices, but to try and identify things which we can do competitively in South Africa. So to make sure that it's the right type of crop which can grow in South Africa, and that we do get the right technology and so on. And it's still in development, so we can't say for certain exactly what the cost structure is going to be, but that is our intention. In companies like Walmart, what we have engaged with Walmart, and we've engaged with other companies on an ongoing basis, and in fact on agro industries in particular, Walmart has indicated that the agricultural area is one of the areas where they actually see potential from South Africa. And not only potential to buy into the local chain, but if we can supply competitively and at a good quality, they're prepared to look at taking South African products into the international markets. So we need to make sure that we hold them to that, we engage with them going forward, and we make sure we equip the local manufacturers and farmers to actually play that role.
Thanks, Shakil. What has been IDC's major strength? I think, firstly, it's the people that we have at the IDC, because those are the people that make the decisions whether these projects can be sustainable going forward. But also, it's the quality of the investments that we've made in the past. Those investments have enabled IDC to, at the back of them, to go out and raise additional funding, so that then we can reinvest into the economy. So, because in terms of the Act, we have to ensure that we finance projects that have economic merit, that are sustainable, that have a chance of making it. That brings the discipline to the IDC to say, let's invest in a project. When we assess the project at that stage, let's be comfortable that that project will be sustainable going forward. Because if it's not, not only its ability to repay you is diminished, but also those jobs that you are hoping that will be created will not be realized. So that has helped us to be able to do that. I think also the fact that we've had relationships with other funders who provide other development finance institutions, because they provide long-term financing, which you wouldn't ordinarily find in the normal banking sector, where they can give us 7, 8, 10-year monies, and then we can be able to invest. I think that has helped us to be able to ensure that we continue to be self-funding. We started the balance sheet that we have. It will be difficult for us to raise additional funding. I think it must be said. But also, then it will also make it a bit of a challenge for us to invest in new projects. So, because some of those investments that we have do give us dividends, and some of them where they've grown then we do divest or we sell them, and then we invest again. So that balance sheet allows us to be able to do that. And without that, it will indeed become difficult for us to continue to be self-funding. This brings a challenge for us to continue to ensure that we replace investments with the ones that are strong themselves, that are sustainable, that can be able to ensure that we continue to have this institution itself self-financing. And naturally, I think the support we get from the board as well and this in the shareholder assist. In terms of the challenges that we find when we're looking at regional integration, I think we do look at all the risks, at least at the point in time when we do that, when we decide whether we want to invest in that, because we do have a unit that looks at the risk assessments. But there is a chance that we would not identify all the risks that are present. But what we've learned as well is that when you invest in a country, I think it's important that the people of that country feel that they are part of the investments, because otherwise they only will be able to support it, not only in terms of supporting in terms of if it's frequenting the place, if it's a hotel establishment, or if they have to buy those products. So it's important that the solution that we bring also talk to those people. I mean, which is why we try by all means. I mean, I don't think we achieve it at all times, that we work with the development finance institutions of those countries as well. But also, when we get into countries as well, we also talk to government. I mean, to also understand what government's position in those countries, because we wouldn't want to go into countries where government is not probably as enthusiastic as it should be. Fortunately, I think in the continent we don't necessarily have those. I mean, with at least from our understanding. So there might be risks that are associated with us investing in the continent, in the region. But I think our thinking is, for Africa to have a chance, it's important that we increase the relationship and the trade between the two countries, or between the number of countries. Because I think it's been said many times that if you look at Africa itself, the trade amongst its own countries is very limited. So somebody has to start. And we don't have to be reckless, but we have to be conscious on that. In terms of the cooperatives, Chair, we don't see cooperatives as only being in the micro business. I think there's an opportunity for it to be in the big ones as well. It will depend how they're configured. Sometimes we configure them in trusts. I mean, for an example, we showed that we're increasing our investment in the green energy. And we know one of the requirements is that the communities that are around there need to be participants there. And in fact, our biggest investments in this has really been to enable those communities to be shareholders in those. For example, if you look at where there's going to be solar farms or wind farms, communities within a certain designated radius should be shareholders, and traditional funders just shy away from funding them. So normally the two sources of funding would be either ourselves as DFI, Development Finance Institutions, or in some cases then it would be the promoters themselves. So we're playing a role there where here we're giving an opportunity for communities to be able to participate in bigger projects. But there's still an opportunity for them to do in the smaller ones. And I think the small business finance entity will be playing more and more a role in that regard. Chair, I hope we've tried to addresses all the questions. If not, I think we will try in the next round. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Babu Qhina. I guess there will be follow-up, obviously, because you are really addressing the core issues in terms of issues related to our mandate as a committee. Ma'am Mokorosi, Ma'am Zotetsi, Babu Ntuli.
What has been alluded to by the CEO in his presentation or clarity giving answers, he said the money that has been approved by IDC is 10 billion. But to the best of my knowledge, if I was following the president correctly, he said set aside was 10 billion and approved was 1.5. Am I correct? And the companies to be creating jobs will be at about 60. and then you are now talking of 30. May we be given clarity as to that regard? And yeah, you talked of 30 as you were talking about it. Clarity to that regard, and then maybe progress made to that effect, and maybe a clarity should also be given to us as to what is that is preventing IDC to maybe approve more than 1.5, if I got you right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Metso Tutsi.
Thank you, Chairperson. On Walmart again. You know, Walmart has said all these good things about how the country is going to benefit from their existence in the country. But their history, you know, always works against them. It's even more worrying if they have this interest in agro-processing. You know, we know this industry is dominated by giants who have been there, you know, long before our emerging black farmers. And it is highly centralized. The scope of black emerging farmers is very limited. Whenever there are opportunities, you know, they're not working for the emerging black farmers. Even the NDP document has alluded to this fact. And the increase of 11%, one wonders to what extent is it going to work for the emerging black farmers in this agro-industry. And to just be curious, if there are other strategies, you know, for us to be, you know, they say forewarned is forearmed. In case there's a sudden change by Walmart, they'll be coming to us at the speed of a lightning. How are you going to combat that? Because the situation now is like a history repeats itself when it comes to the development of emerging farmers in agro-processing. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Metso Tutsi. That Julie.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, the CEO has said they are going regional about coaching. I want to check what is the problem with South Africa producing coaching. I remember when we attended that agricultural conference, they were saying that they on quoting, they can create about 1 million jobs. I want to check that how, what is the, why should we go out to the neighboring countries whilst there is a potential here? And I want to check, Chairperson, the funds for skills development. We were told in the higher education presentation that each and every entity will be able to set aside funds for the skills development, not particularly for your department, but for the country. I want to check that whether you've got such funds set aside for that for this current budget. Lastly, Chair, we are told that Germany is leading when it comes to solar system, and Germany is at the northern hemisphere where it is cold, and I'm looking at us as South Africa. Why are we behind when it comes to solar system, because I was thinking that we'll be able just to do more than Germany. What are we not doing, or what are they doing? So that's the. Lastly, is the. Okay, the last one, but this one I don't need a response now. But Chair, I'm worried, Baba Cream. You clarified disbursement. You have disbursed so billion. We are just ticking boxes that we have issued so money, but nobody looks inside what is happening after the money has been disbursed when it comes to job and creation. But I don't need it now. That one is just the homework. Thanks.
No. It needs to be responded to. It's a very important one. Babuqina has responses and must have them with his delegation. Thank you very much. Babuqina, I think I just want to understand in terms of the financing for distress companies. Last year you told us that the challenge you had is around monitoring, and you are going to be looking at improving on your monitoring of especially those companies, the performance of those companies that you have funded. Can we be then informed as to how much, or is there any difference from the time you have, for instance, assisted them? How far are they in terms of sustenance? What are the challenges if they still experience challenges? Are you seeing any improvement in terms of the repayment levels? Because that would serve as an indication as to whether they are improving performance or not. I think if we can be and keep, yes, the president told us it's 60 companies. Can you just give us an indication, are they in the macro, micro, levels? We just want to have a clear picture of what's happening there. And related to that, I know IDC is involved with big picture issues. Is this function or responsibility correctly put, or is it something that you can consider perhaps delegating it further to this mesh entity going forward so that you're not diverted to, from the bigger responsibility that you have? I'm just asking that question out of interest, because while we believe this is a very important task that you've been given, and we also appreciate the fact that you have a bigger responsibility, and therefore you might tend to neglect, because, and this might be diverting you from your bigger responsibility, but we want to hear from you if our assessment or analysis is correct. Secondly, we normally are told green jobs are not that sustainable, or if, for instance, we are to invest in green economy and produce green jobs, we run the risk of, for instance, the established companies now losing people or retrenching people if they are to convert in terms of focusing on green issues. I don't know how true is that, but are you envisaging really, in terms of the projects that you have invested in, more jobs, sustainable jobs? I'm asking this because you are directly involved in this, so that we don't, rely on something that we know that is not going to improve the job creation situation in South Africa. You know that there are many people who normally predict something else, so we just want to hear from you this time. Lastly, how do you ensure, we've seen now Kuga being, launched. Is it Mocha or Kuchan? Yeah. Mocha project, yes. The committee has been there last year. Okay. I think he understands what I want to say. The committee was there last year, and we were sort of informed of challenges related to how the province and the municipality initiatives are not supported by the IDC. I don't know how true is that, but I want to ask you a question as to how do you, in your day-to-day work, ensure cooperation with provinces, especially when investing your own projects, and whenever provinces and municipalities come with new projects, you know, that require funding from yourselves. How is that cooperation going? And maybe lastly, to ask if the department, what is the role of department in ensuring that it assists you in that regard? I'm not seeing any further hands, which means members want to go to financials now. May I give you the opportunity to respond, and then after that we'll go to the financials.
Thanks, Chair. If I caused any confusion, let me apologize. In fact, when I said the IDC approved 10 billion, that's the facility that we have. Because I think if I can take just the members back to the State of the Nation in 2011, the President said IDC will set aside 10 billion, but he said in addition there'll be a jobs fund which is administered by the DBSA. So when that approved, I was referring to that. So apologies if I caused confusion. The numbers that the President has now, which he mentioned in the State of the Nation, those were the correct numbers. Today, 10 billion we have, 1.5, and those companies. So because those are the numbers we provided. So I think the President was spot on. So apologies for confusing the members. The issue of of Walmart, Chair, I think maybe the Competition Commission will try. I think we've addressed to the best of what we could, Chair. For us, the challenge will not. For us, we see an opportunity where we can work with them to increase local procurement. I think that's what we will try and do. We'll engage with them to make sure, be it not only agriculture, throughout all in everything that they do, we will engage with them and work with our local players to engage with them to see how best we can provide them with goods locally so that then they can be able to sell. But other than that, Chair, maybe we'll leave it to the Competition Commission to try. The issue of cotton, the example that I made, it's not to the exclusion of what we have in South Africa. It's in addition to that. Because we know, truth be told, in other countries like Mali, their yields are much better. To say then how do we work together. Where we can, I mean, we know there are areas in South Africa that produce it, and just to see how best we all of us together work and then improve the efficiencies thereof. So it's not to say we wouldn't invest here, but we'll just do that. It's in addition to that. Because we know in some of these African countries, what they do is they plant the cotton, they export it to Europe. I mean, unbeneficiated or anything, to say, let's use an opportunity to beneficiate in South Africa. It also helps on the skills as well, that we increase the skills level to the beneficiated ones. In terms of what we've set aside, I mean, we've... maybe I'll leave the skills development question to Shakil. He can answer it better, because we have some interventions that we have. But let me come to the issue of Germany, solar. Why? I think the process now that we see government has taken to invest in, or at least to encourage or promote alternative energy, of which solar will be one of them, is trying to address that. I mean, it's not only Germany. You look at Spain, for an example. I mean, actually, Spain is actually leading by far, not only in terms of the technology and the players that they have, but the amount of energy that they generate from that, whereas they've got limited sun in comparison to us. So we're on that path. What is probably...
has resulted in developing countries being a bit slow is the cost of the technology, because it is still expensive. Even when here in South Africa we will be embarking on this, there's a cost to that. There's an element of subsidy. I think that's something that we always have to bear in mind. Naturally now I think we're seeing more and more ways of trying to keep the costs down, which will help. I mean, if you look in Spain, for an example, where for a long time the government there was subsidizing, and now the government is actually relooking at how best to can subsidize, because it can be very expensive compared to the alternatives that we have, which are not very friendly to the climate, by the way. So I think as a country we're going to the right way, but we need to become comfortable that we can put in technologies that we can be able to sustain as a country, because there's an element of subsidization. In terms of the level of our activities, Chair, I hope we're not ticking the box. I really hope we're not. We're trying not to, which is why we look at the jobs that we've created. We look at where they are created, which is why we also talk, when we talk, that's why we have offices in the different provinces, because we know some provinces need a bit more effort to assist in ensuring that there's development in those ones. This is against this is informed by that we should see development happening in all of, and that we shouldn't be just comfortable to say we've approved 15 billion, whatever the billions are, but we also look at the number of jobs that are being created, because it's that impact for us. When we look at how successful we've been, we there's outcomes in one of the slides that we have. I think Shakil, this that one there, the outcomes. We look at a number of factors. It's not only the jobs, the equity, the SME, and all of that. Because to us, that's when we get the satisfaction to say we've done our work. It's not only just the amounts of money. If an impression is being created, I want to give comfort to the committee that we're not just ticking boxes. We want to see some of those being achieved. It's not only the value. Chair, you asked the question on the distress funding in terms of how the split and all of that. I think we can provide the committee, because we didn't bring that here, in terms of where is it, in terms of the level, small, micro, and where it is. I think we can provide, we'll make note, we'll provide the secretary with those stats, because we do keep stress.
Including the 6 billion commitment.
Yes. In relation to that the distress funding. Yeah. To say where it is, in which sectors, and the sizes of the companies. We didn't bring the information, but we will provide that, Chair. There has been cases, in fact, Chair, where because of our intervention, we've seen companies turn around. We've seen some of those examples. Some of them, it's not only the small companies, by the way, which we've assisted. Some of the large companies, some of them would be significant in value, and they've been in distress, and IDC has come in, and we've assisted them, and we're seeing a turnaround time. So it's not only the small ones. Shakil is whispering to me a company, but I said I'll give him a chance to talk about it, because we have some of those companies, actually listed companies, Chair, which we've assisted, where they're in distress, actually come back. So I also know the committee visited one of the forest companies, I think in Finnish and Forest one, which was also in distress, if I'm not mistaken, which we also participated.
I told you, it's closed.
Shakil will respond, Chair.
Yes,
respond.
I met some of the shareholders there.
Okay, Shakil will respond. He is, by the way, a director, is also, that's why he can respond. Okay, we'll give him a chance, Chair. There's a question on jobs, green jobs, are they sustainable? Are we going to create more sustainable jobs? Chair, it's informed by technologies. In fact, what we will do, maybe if we can just note this, there's a report that we did, IDC together with TBSA and who's the other one? And TIPS, where we did a report, Chair, on green jobs. We will make copies. We'll just make sure that the committee members have copies to say where are the jobs. Where can these jobs be created? Can you indeed create sustainable jobs in the green economy? We think you can. There are technologies where you don't create as many jobs as you want to. So if you look rent for rent, you might in certain sectors create more jobs vis-a-vis in green, but we're talking just direct jobs. So if we look on the manufacturing of the components and all of that, there's an opportunity. We'll make that copy available, Chen, so that we can see. So there's an opportunity to have sustainable jobs in that. In terms of us cooperating with provinces and local municipalities, Chair, through the provincial offices that we have and their satellites, that's what we try and do, to say let's be closer to the province, let's work with them in terms of their provincial priorities and guidelines. So we work with them. We'll find that our provincial offices, I also do sometime from time to time, they meet with provincial governments, understand their priorities, and then try and work with them. The success is mixed, but we do that. Also, we have development agencies which, to some extent, do work with local municipalities to try and assist and find where the opportunities are. In relation to Kuga, Chair, maybe we need to get a bit more info on that particular case, but we do have investments, actually, in Kuga. I think there's about three. There's one, Shekel talked about the dairy, for an example. That's in Kuga. We have a fishing... onshore fishing and the biomass. There's a couple of projects that we have in Kuga. Maybe the committee would remember right at the beginning when Kuga was started, I mean, there was thinking of putting an aluminium smelter, for an example, there where we did the work. So we, as IDC, did some work. There's been a number of projects which have been stop starts, which have not worked. But we also know there's a sizable smelter which is still planned for manganese to be in Kuga. So we're still planning to have that. So we do work with the Kuga Development Agency. But if there are any specifics, Chair, we would welcome those so that we can try and follow those up. I'll give an opportunity to Shekel to answer the others.
Just to start very briefly with the company that you visited in Sabi. In fact, at the time you visited them, they were going through a retrenchment process, and they were, in fact, since then, they've actually turned the business around. The funding has been restructured as part of what we did. They've rehired some of the people that they've let off. So it is a success story in terms of supporting a company. In terms of the learners, we support learners in four ways. We have a top learnership program where we support CAs or people to register as CAs. We support them through their training, as opposed to an auditing company, as opposed to their serving the articles at an auditing company. We take in some people who can serve the articles with IDC. Then we also take on matriculant learners in the learnership to help them to pick up office administration skills. And we take on unemployed graduates to take them through a business graduate internship. Now, all of these are not our employees necessarily in the normal sense of these are specifically as part of a training initiative to support the country's needs. Over and above that, we do give bursaries to students. Currently, there's over 200 students that we're giving bursaries to. We try and focus it on areas which are scarce skills, but it's not all skills that we require as IDC, although some of them do end up applying to IDC after that. In terms of numbers, as I mentioned, there's over 200 students we're currently giving a bursary to, and there's 20 learners which we're currently supporting, and the intention, and those we keep for a prescribed period, and then they go out and look for additional work once they've got the experience. We would like to, in the coming year, to increase that to about 30 learnerships. We currently have about 20, or we've got 20 currently. in the current financial year. We want to increase it to 30 in the next year.
Okay. I take it that concludes your responses. I've asked serious questions. I can see that you're running away from some of them. It's okay. We can engage outside this. But members, I really wanted to give you more time for the financials, but because of time limitation, really, the time allocated for IDC is over. Lest we want to finish later after two today. It robs us of that opportunity to have you know, responses to questions that are not clear in our minds. But unfortunately, we don't. That's what in terms of time, that's all we have for today. This doesn't mean it's the end of our engagement with the IDC. When we come back from recess, we will continue to engage for the rest of the financial year, next financial year. Thank you very much, Babu Tina and the team, for honoring us, and also for the sterling work that you continue to do. We're happy that you are really aligning now in terms of yourselves, in terms of where the country wants you to go to. Hence, you have made a great pronouncement that there will be some limits in terms of financing. I hope I'm quoting you correctly, and focus more on development, which is to us a very, very positive move. We also are happy that three entities are now going to be your subsidiary, meaning that your experience and your resources that you have are going to help in developing them further, so that they are able to improve their services to our people. And I'm hoping that there's still some of the work that you are doing that is of to me, not that much of macro at a macro level, but that you might consider also handing over to the entities, to the new entity. Otherwise, good luck for the coming year. We'll meet, I think, soon when we deal with your annual reports, and that will give us more opportunity then. Perhaps we can give you the whole day, dedicate the whole day for that, so that we are able to finish off even the work that we've started here. Thank you very much, members. Thank you very much to the IDC. Mr. Levine, thank you also for availing yourselves. You know that you had the challenges. May we then now have 5 minutes comfort break, and then we come back to hear what the Competition Commission has for us. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. I
Can we come back? Members, thank you very much. We are now having an opportunity to consider the strike plan for the Competition Commission. Can we be one, please? Thank you. We are considering a strike plan for Competition Commission. We know that last week you had to turn back. We even thought of talking to the pilots for those who were already on board their flights that they turned back to Johannesburg. But we really appreciate your understanding for coming back and to present to us this important document. Competition authorities are very, very important, and one of the very important entities. We are hoping that today's presentation will tell us as to how far have you integrated your work to the to the work that is directing us to where the government is heading to. I don't know whether I'm clear, but what I'm trying to say, government has particular strategic objectives and particular goals set for itself to achieve, and what you want to know is how far have you, for instance, complied in ensuring that the path that you're moving into is really directing to that direction. Obviously, I think the time we are a bit late and we're behind time, and we're hoping that finding time will also deal with some of the issues that were raised during the IDC engagement with the IDC, and we're hoping that we'll be able to clarify them with you, because there are overlapping issues from what members have asked. May I then, without a waste of time, I think you had the introductions, hand over to you to introduce your delegation for the purposes of the new members, and then head on to your presentation. Thank you. Over to you, Mr. Ramborod.
Thank you very much, Chair. And once again, thank you for allowing us the opportunity to engage with you on our plan, strategic plans for the forthcoming years. If I can just introduce my delegation, on my first left is Wendy Mkhwanazi, who's our Chief Legal Counsel and heads up our Legal Services Division, and then Mahendran Mudli is our Chief Finance Officer. Unfortunately, the Deputy Commissioner couldn't make it today because we had to split up because of other appointments we had to look to see to. Chair, our plans have been tabled, both our strategic plan and our annual performance plan. And I will take, so there's detail in those documents, but I will take you through them very briefly and highlight the issues that we are raising in those documents. And we can, I'd like to spend more time with questions, because I think that's where we can address exactly the issues you want to address. Just a point that I always have to make is that just to locate the current plan and our strategic planning process, the Competition Commission plans in detail. A strategic boss barrage type planning exercise happens every 3 years. That's our planning cycle, and in the next financial year, starting next month, is when we will do that again. In other words, we've just completed the third of the 3 years in our previous strat plan, major strat plan exercise, and we will do that again in the next financial year, which means some fresh planning in detail. And that planning we take very seriously. We kind of could be very consultative in that planning. We speak to our stakeholders and their input into how we see the way forward. And we're also hoping that we can get input from this committee around our next planning cycle, our next strategic planning process. The last process, for example, at that point we used to report to the ministry, to the DGI, and the Minister of Trade and Industry spent the first morning of our strategic planning exercise with us, kind of talking through his vision of what the organization should be like. And so the current plans are based on that, and we would want to expand our consultative process around this in the next strat plan. So, but an important point about the strat plan is that it is a multi-year plan. We don't kind of plan fresh every year and change direction every year. A lot of the issues we're dealing with do necessarily have to be implemented over multiple years. That's how long litigation takes. That's how long investigation takes. So it is a lot of, you know, it's no coincidence that you hear about similar cases every year when we come here, except hopefully, well, certainly there's progress in each one of them. We're moving forward with it. So a lot of these are multi-year plans, and we don't do this fresh every year. Just to remind everybody that the mandate of the Commission broadly looks at three things. Firstly, our merger control powers is there to prevent concentration in any market going forward. So we prevent high levels of concentration that may occur as a consequence of a merger. The provisions for us to deal with anti-competitive behavior is to look at firm behavior that has already occurred. This is a ex post thing, a backward looking thing, where somebody's already done something and be investigating them for having done something. So this is opposed to merger, where you're preventing something from happening in the future. And then the third major area of our work is advocacy, where we engage with regulators, legislation and policy generally to encourage and to persuade people to adopt pro-competitive policies and regulations in their area of work. And most of that is targeted at policymakers, but also to businesses around kind of compliance with the legislation. Part of our advocacy function is to persuade business to adopt pro-competitive behaviors in the way that they run their businesses. I think in the kind of situation analysis that gives rise to our current plan, I think is very, very interesting in this current year. I think that there's a lot of expectations generally for competition policy and law to bring about genuine economic transformation. People are asking important questions about what the outcomes of our work is, what the impact is, are we achieving anything in concrete? And at the same time, we have, through our experience in dealing with priority sectors, deepened our own understanding of how these markets work and have kind of adjusted our strategies on how we address anti-competitive behaviors in these markets. But I think that the biggest thing that's happening in the last immediate period to the competition authorities is that we find ourselves caught between, on the one hand, a very strict and punishing legalism where the respondents' firms who we're prosecuting are challenging us on procedural grounds and are wanting to kind of really narrow and restrict what we can and cannot do. So there's a very strict legalism on the one side, and at the same time, on the opposite side, there's expectations for us to be far more populist in our approach. There's a populism where people want us to be dealing with, to widen our approach, to deal with all manner of public interest issues and incorporate them in our decision making. And this is something that, interestingly, is occurring at the same time. And this is all you'll find, this is the way this expresses itself is in the last financial year, in the recent past, since September last year, we've had three constitutional court cases challenging court decisions that attempt to narrow down our roles, that attempt to restrict what we can and cannot do. There's a feeling, while on the one hand there's a feeling in the business community that we are law unto ourselves, we take decisions willy-nilly, we're far too powerful in the way we kind of deal with them. On the other hand, there's a feeling from you know, there's this populist sentiment saying that we're not doing enough, we're not dealing with the more popular issues, we should be taking a much wider approach in the way we take our decisions, we should be taking into account, we should be putting more weight on public interest issues in the way we take our decisions. I think it is very interesting that that occurs at the same time, and I think that we will enter the next financial year with greater clarity on both issues, because those constitutional court cases will come out shortly as well, and we've had a decision on Walmart, I think, which represents the kind of more populist pressures we've been under. So I mean, you know, there's adverse court decisions which we're dealing with, and there's kind of greater and competing expectations from stakeholders around these issues all occurring at the same time. And then significantly in our external environment, there is the new growth path that we have to align to, that I'll come back to, and there is indeed within the business community greater emphasis being placed on corporate governance, and there is for us many more strategic engagement opportunities with government departments and policymakers. A lot of them come, you know, unsolicited from our side. We're being approached more and more by government departments to assist in policy making. I think significantly in the recent past around healthcare, the Minister of Health is very keen to work with us around kind of unblocking some issues around pricing in the private healthcare market, for example. But very, very importantly, in the bigger picture, one of the things that's occurring in our so-called external operating environment is that we're seeing in the marketplace many new technologies and many new markets. In other words, there are new markets being created as we speak. We've heard about these in the telecommunications sector, in the energy sector. We've spoken about green industry. These are brand new markets that are beginning to develop. There's great challenges around intellectual property rights with new technologies, particularly in IT, and I would imagine also in green industry and energy going forward. And we, as a competition agency, has to be sensitive to this and be on top of it and understand what it means for us as a regulator of competition. In these new markets that are developing, are we creating playing fields that are equal and that that foster competitiveness amongst the incumbents in those markets? The Competition Commission has never had a problem with its alignment with government policy. We are aligned kind of formally with the outcome, so-called outcome 4 of the Economic Development Department's strategy, which is decent employment through growth. And for each of the outputs for that department, we inevitably play some kind of contributory role around that. So there's no, we don't have to force our, you know, a kind of rationale around why we are relevant, as it were. I think very significant for the alignment is the thing I'd like to flag, because it's something that's going to be a major part of our work in the next financial period is the work we've done in the construction industry, where we have investigated cartels both in the product markets, which is the cement and the bricks and the whatever, you know, the steel, etc., but also very importantly the work we've done in the bidding markets where construction firms bid for projects and where we've uncovered a number of bid rigging cartels that operate. Of course, that everybody will appreciate raises the cost to government. Government pays much more for these projects, for these construction projects, when cartels operate in bidding for these projects, and that is important work we have done with respect to the which is kind of aligned with government's broader policy around infrastructure development and employment creation. In the internal operating environment, our workload steadily increases over time, as is kind of evidenced by a number of cases we have, the number of agreements we reach with companies, the amounts of fines we levy, and we increasingly need more and more staff. We need training is a big issue, and the quality of our work is a big issue, and we put a lot of energy into that because that's important for the integrity of our institution as a whole. And so you'll see that while we're expanding as an organization in terms of the number of people, we're also strengthening our information and knowledge management organizationally. And increasingly we have to, because a lot of the cases we deal with are dealing with very specific, peculiar markets that, you know, we don't have the expertise for. We have to hire in expertise for specific cases if they're heavily contested in order to enable us to deal with that more effectively. So essentially those are the kind of issues that informed what our strat plan for the next year is, and as I've pointed out, we will kind of go through a bigger exercise. So next year's strat plan is likely to look more significantly different, but this being the final year of our current strat plan, we kind of on pretty much the same path we have been last year, where our three strategic goals are about demonstrating competitive outcomes in the economy in the way we prioritize cases and sectors. Firstly, and that the slide shows which of our programs and departments are responsible for that. We also committed to kind of in our strategically to enter into partnerships with other agencies and other players in the economy, both policymakers and businesses, and through engagement and dialogue and advocacy influence behavior and influence what priority is given to policy issues. And then thirdly, and very, very importantly, as I've pointed out earlier, is to have a high-performing regulatory authority. That is extremely important to us because we are a kind of organization that's always going to be controversial and under fire, and you know, people are always going to ask questions about us, and it's important that we know what we're talking about. We have a strong institution. The institution takes good decisions. There's good people. There's good training. There's good expertise, because we're often having to defend ourselves in very controversial circumstances, and you can't do that without having a strong institution. The next slide is a very detailed slide, but I think that all of the details are in the document. And essentially, it kind of outlines all of the specific activities we undertaking to give effect to each of our three strategic goals. I won't go into them in detail, except to say once again that one of the things in achieving demonstrable outcomes that we've been keen to undertake, and which is something that's likely to happen in the next financial year, is the question of market inquiries in selected markets, and people know that this is something that depends upon the promulgation of or the coming into effect of certain sections of the Amendment Act. But there's increasing pressure on us to fulfill this function, particularly, as I said earlier, regarding healthcare costs. Then, Chair, I'm now moving on to our specific plan for next year, for the next financial year, which starts in 2 weeks' time. And just to say here, we have determined our performance indicators, and we should do this freshly each year rather than cutting and pasting from the previous years. But we've looked at the case pipeline, in other words, what cases are coming up. You know, there's a kind of sequence from receiving a complaint to investigating a complaint to preparing for prosecution to actually prosecuting it before a tribunal, and then if that case then goes on to be appealed, there's the process starts again at an appeal court. So a case could, there's a big pipeline that occurs in any one single case. And we've looked at that, we've looked at past trends, we've looked at our prioritization, and basically we have determined our performance indicators onto two main work streams, which is the mergers, as I explained, the forward-looking stuff, and the enforcement, which is the backward-looking stuff, and we've determined our indicators on that. And I will very, very briefly take you through them. In terms of mergers and acquisitions, we have a bunch of very administrative indicators here, which kind of tells you how long we will take to consider a case. This is very important. It was one of the issues that was a subject matter of the Walmart case, for example. But there is expectations, you know, amongst the business community at least, that an agency like us acts very quickly and efficiently, and that we don't kind of drag our heels. So kind of giving people certainty around how long we will take to take a decision is important, and we are within, very, very within the benchmark for any organization the world over like ours. In other words, best practice the world over in terms of our turnaround times, we in that ballpark. We don't take any longer than any other agency in the world. And so there's those kinds of indicators. It is, of course, really difficult for anybody to accurately predict the number of mergers that's going to occur in the economy in the next year. We don't know that, and we would only be able to determine that from past trends, and we could be wrong, and anything could happen that would either increase or decrease that number. But the point I want to highlight, and I don't kind of, we don't do this, I mean, I've put it all on the slide, and it might not be organized in the best way, but I think it's important information here that in the recent past, we have had a far greater number of contested merger cases than we had predicted. You know, usually of like 300 or 400 mergers we look at in a year, we prohibit 2 or 3. So there's a very small number of the total number of mergers that get prohibited. And then, you know, another 10, 15 will have conditions on them. But the vast majority of mergers just kind of, you know, are not problematic. But when they are problematic, they are very problematic. They take a lot of time and resources in analysis and in argument, etc. So, and I've just put all of these on the slide because these were decisions, a lot of these decisions were taken in the current financial year, but the hearings and the will occur in the next financial year, and there's something that I would encourage members of this committee to follow and to get an understanding of what the issues are in each of these mergers. Then in the enforcement side, which is the kind of backward looking where somebody's already done a bad thing and we're investigating them, Here, we've also got a whole bunch of administrative indicators trying to predict how many of cases we will that will go through the organization in the year. These are also based on past trends, and from our pipeline, we know what's coming up. I'm not going to kind of go through each of those in any more detail. Just except to say that it is one of the indicators we've got to give is how many cases do we think we lose, or how many cases we think we win as opposed to lose. And we've very ambitiously said, you'll see in the lower column, in the lower table here, that we're going to win 85% of our cases. I'm not sure how, you know, those are just kind of, that's also something we kind of basing on our past trend, if you like. We've kind of been winning more cases than we've been losing, but it's a bit of an unfair thing to hold any agency accountable to, because if any agency is saying they're going to win 100% of every single loss one of their cases, they're going to become very risk averse and not fight the good fight when that's necessary, even though they're going to lose it. So I just kind of ask that you look at these performance indicators in context in that way. It is also, I should say, at this point, very difficult in planning to, and Wendy faces this problem all the time, very difficult in planning to know beforehand how many cases are going to be controversial and how controversial they're going to be. And it's hard to predict whether parties will appeal or not appeal. If they appeal, we're talking lots of resources spent in courtrooms and hiring lawyers. If they don't, then it just goes away. So planning for us around that becomes a very difficult thing to work out exactly how much of resources any one case will take. I've put together a bunch of slides which I'm really not going to go into any detail over. And these slides are important because they're over and above what's in some of the documents you have, because they tell you in the pipeline, which is the column at the bottom, you know, there's an investigator, you have somebody either giving you a corporate leniency, asking for corporate leniency, or a case is an investigation stage or in a hearing stage or in a settlement stage, or we're waiting for a decision, or it's on appeal or review. That's the kind of pipeline. And I've produced a kind of slide like this for each of our priority sectors, trying to indicate where our different cases at present are in this pipeline. So this one is around food and agro-processing. And you can see it deals with a number of cases which we've reported on previously are in progress. The next slide deals with construction and infrastructure, and these are mostly the cases in the product market. So you'll see aluminium and bricks and steel, and it doesn't include, for example, all of the cases that we've taken up in the bid rigging side of these investigations. And then the third slides are in intermediate industrial products, which looks at the chemicals and the scrap metal and wire and the steel markets and the polymer markets, which involves Sasol. And then there's some cases around telecommunications as well that are at a hearing stage. And this is, I mean, these are the kinds of things you will read about in the newspaper in the first part of the next financial year, because they're currently in progress within the authorities at some stage in the pipeline. Then, of course, we did point out that one of the things we do is also advocacy and dealing with stakeholders and getting people to, you know, doing the moral suasion thing around getting people to change their behavior. And here we continue to engage with stakeholders, particularly business and government. We comment on the number of bills and acts that are before other portfolio committees in Parliament and make our input either to the department or directly to the portfolio committees. We also, very interestingly, participate and increasingly more so in international policy development. And here the two things that are really important is the Africa Competition Forum. The African Competition Forum, I've been elected the vice chair of this forum. It's okay, thank you. And there is a lot of expectation from other African agencies on us in South Africa to provide assistance and guidance and capacity building, and we often, you know, 4, 5, 6 times a year get delegations from other African countries coming to speak to us and talk to us, and there's secondments of their staff for sometimes extended periods of time. So 2-3 months people will come and work with our staff and then go back, and that's a part of how we contribute to that. Also not on the slide, and I think increasingly will become a bigger part of our international work, is BRICS has a special forum on competition. We attended for the first time in Beijing last year, and we would be expected to participate more and more in that policy forum. So that's our advocacy work. You'll see that our biggest resource are human beings, are people. A lot of our work is in the form of an investigation or an analysis, and that's where, you know, people power is what we rely on. We put a lot of effort into our training to ensure that our staff is enabled to do this work properly. We have, and we have had for many years, a very successful, I think, graduate trainee program. There are people who are in very senior positions in the organization right now that started off many years ago as graduate trainees. So graduate trainees are people just out of university, no job. This is the first job they've ever had, and this is an opportunity for them to learn on the job. It turns out graduate trainees are a very competitive thing. You know, it's not like we have to, we compete with a number of other agencies to get the best graduate trainees. We've had 14 in the last year and intend to have 14 new people in the next year. We also have, in addition to kind of the staff training, which is around the content of our work, have put a lot of effort into training people on management, on project management, on how to run organizations properly. And here we've had an executive coaching program for all our senior managers, and we've had a management development program for our middle management. You know, the difficulty we have is that a lot of people come into the organization as very good and skilled economists or lawyers, but they lack the management skill. They haven't been trained in management, and so they get promoted on the basis of being a good lawyer or a good economist, and then we need to back that up with, you know, for them to succeed by ensuring they also get these management skills. We also very encourage people to do, we kind of heavily incentivize people to do further studies. There's many people in the organization doing master's degrees and honors degrees, and that's encouraged. By all accounts, a very solid corporate governance structure around how decisions get taken. The Competition Commission takes something like, 20 decisions a week on a merger or an issue. It's like decision-making must happen very rapidly, and structures must function properly for that. And so we've put in place all of these structures to ensure that there's checks and balances in the organization around good decision-making. Then finally, with respect to our budget, and very briefly, you'll see that firstly, about 3/4 of our money comes from the fiscus, voted funds, it should be, it should read the EDD there, not DTI. So, you know, while we get income from people who file their mergers, that's only about a quarter of the total amount of money that we use. And I think very significantly is most of our money is spent on HR and people and salaries. And then there's about 20% of the total expenditures on case-related work. And the least amount of our money is around, you know, operational costs around rent, etc. These figures, of course, do not include the fines that are levied. They're not here at all, because that money doesn't get reflected in our books. It goes straight into the fiscus. Okay, so sure. I mean, I think very significant here is, you know, if the total amount we're going to spend last is around 230, 240 million, I think very significant to note is that in the last two or perhaps 3 years at least, we have, our fines have exceeded the total amount of money we spend as an institution. Okay. And then finally, it's at the end. Okay, well, this is my last slide. I think it's important for us to, and our strat plan kind of details this, be very good at kind of understanding what our risks are. Risk management is like one of the big fads at the moment in management and auditing, and we kind of spend a lot of time paying attention to that. I've covered some of this, and we've dealt with some of this in previous years, but we continue to have space constraints as a risk. Of course, those adverse decisions by the court might pose to be risks to us if they go against us in a way that makes it more difficult for us to function. Our increasing caseload and kind of impacting on the quality of our work. I've mentioned the fact that it's difficult in predicting litigation costs and therefore planning very finely, because you never know which case is going to prove difficult and you never know who's going to challenge your decision. And then I think very important is the second but last point around measuring impact, which I've spoken about. I think that is going to be an issue that we need to engage more on, where there's increasingly greater expectation for us to demonstrate our impact. And this, of course, is not a very easy thing to do with respect to the work we have. We do, I mean, we kind of create conditions for higher level of competition in the economy, but the causality of us doing an investigation and then saying, well, this number of jobs or this kind of whatever indicator you choose occurred directly because of our intervention is not always an easy argument to make. I mean, I think that we up to this challenge, because I think that, you know, we do, everybody working in this institution would like to think they are effective, but then how do you measure that and how do you know that you are effective is something that we are increasingly, I think, going to pay attention to. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Ramburuth, for the presentation. Members, here is a presentation that is very, very well prepared. I'm noting Babuntuli, Babu Mubu, Mr. Hussein, Metodezi.
Thanks, Chairperson, and I would like to welcome the presentation by the Commissioner. Chairperson, if you look at the mandate of the Competition Commission, and we look at the unemployment, I would like the Commissioner or the Competition Commission to take us into their confidence. We've been talking about co-ops to be given capacity, nurturing, and supported. The government has been talking about ring fencing, the local procurement for the people around the hospitals, the schools. I want to find out from the Competition Commission, what is your take? I know that those co-ops won't succeed because of the competition. There are big companies who are coming from outside just to supply whatever is needed in the hospital. If you look at your mandate, have you ever looked in that area of the co-op, how to assist them to acquire this local procurement instead of competing with the big companies? Thanks, Chairperson.
Thanks, Babantuli. Dr. Mobo.
Thank you, Chair. Please forgive me if my question sounds a little bit naive, but I need to understand this. What are the obvious or most serious sanctions that are imposed on cartels, for example, that are found to have been engaged in price fixing? In other words, what would be the most serious sanction that can be imposed? Secondly, you mentioned, and in your slide number 16, that you have lost a number of cases in the courts. My question is, what are the implications on you when you lose cases like that? Does that diminish your credibility as an organization? And probably the most stupid question would be, are mergers such a bad thing after all? If, for example, the two local companies that say to one another, we would like to merge so that we can benefit from the economies of scale and the strengths of our own business skills or whatever else qualities that they might have, and they say, look, we want to merge and become a bigger organization, a bigger competitor. I want to know, is this really such a bad thing? Is mergers really a bad thing? Just want to clarify on that. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Babu. Dr. Mabu. Ms. Dawson.
Chair, thank you very much. Allow me please to make a comment first and to say that I think for the short while, over a short period of time, the Competition Commission was very able to stamp its authority in the country in a manner that gives many South Africans hopes that there is this body that actually looks after the interests of many people in the country, and I want to commend it for the good work that it has been doing. The downside of that is that the more people know about the good work you do, the more increased caseloads you will get. And I think that is starting to reflect on your slides there. And so my question is specifically around that is, whilst I know you can attribute the increase in caseloads to education, that more companies or more people know about the work that you do, what do you attribute the increase in caseloads to specifically around food industry, as far as food is concerned, and how that impacts on the poorer communities? Because I think we're starting to see more and more cartels coming out, especially around food and dumping and all of that with the chickens and bread and whatnot. So if you could please just speak with that, to that. And then linked to that is advocacy working as far as that is concerned? Are we getting any positive spin-offs from the advocacy program? Then the second one is, I came previously from the Health Portfolio Committee, and I recall the Minister Minister of Health, who is very committed to trying to reduce the pricing in the private sector on some clinical operations that are conducted, and even on medication and stuff like that. And obviously he was very committed to do that, to try and make the services more available to the poorer communities. But through the introduction of that price controls, or the suggested price controls, the Competition Commission ruled against it and said it's actually not, it's anti-competitive. Now, how do you find that balance on the one hand to try and direct the market to providing a service as cheaply as possible in something as important as the healthcare sector, but on the other hand, promote or try to prevent anti-competitive behavior? And in cases like that, is the Competition Commission not having an adverse effect? Just your comment on that, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Dawson. Methodist.
Thank you, Chair. On slide 6, about reducing youth unemployment, you know, also putting measures to limit job losses, I think it's good news to us, and really applaud it. But now I'm thinking about a threat to this opportunity. Do you have, I don't know to what extent, do you manage a situation whereby, you know, example of a telecom, that when we impose a fine, the company retaliates by, you know, retrenchment, working against this unemployment you are trying to reduce. And in the list of contested measure cases, what is a measure case? Okay. I thought I'll see maybe in cases in, see, in suspense or just waiting. I don't know which you know better word I can use. But the cases that are still in process to be attended to, like the one of Telkom, you know, sometimes we read newspapers, sometimes we have this heavy load and not read the newspaper, and we miss out in terms of progress on such cases. I think the typical example of what Mr. Mugu was talking about, that this heavy fine. And the other one. Oh, and on the strained human capacity, you make mention of management. I was just being curious to know the capacity relating to your investigative skill. That do you have capacity in that area? But the outcome of your case is a showcase that you do have capacity, but just to know if that is enough.
Thank you, Metsotetsi. Mem Khorose. I just want, I had a question, but I didn't have an example. The question by Mr. Hussein actually helped me with the example. The Act, for instance, exempt companies involved in the anti-competitive behavior only if the outcome benefits the previously disadvantaged businesses or enterprises. In the case he has given, for instance, I just want to know whether the commission has appealed that verdict. Yes, I'm using your case as an example in the housing case. I mean health. Why am I saying health? Housing health case, yes. And if you have appealed in that regard, it would help us because that to me it talks to one of your mandate of ensuring that you promote a greater spread of ownership, in particular to increase the ownership stakes of historically disadvantaged people. Here I would say talks to them being remaining in or participating in the economy. I don't know if my context is might be different, but I'm using the same example that he has given. Just to understand, to what extent also have you, using the same example, really helped in ensuring that there is more participation of the historically disadvantaged companies in the economic mainstream? In a sense that when you normally talk to our small, medium enterprises, they will tell you that we can't make it because of the anti-competitive nature of bigger businesses. Their practices makes it difficult for us to really remain within the mainstream. Otherwise, we are forced then to be either liquidated or to just drop everything because we can't afford maybe the prices, or we don't have choices in terms of where to get certain material or so. That would be also in the cases that are involving construction, within the construction industry. I had another question. It just got lost here. You know, I write in all those documents, so they normally confuse me because, yeah. There's somewhere where you mentioned that sometimes it's very difficult to evaluate yourself, the impact you are making on the ground, because maybe you lack, if I were to summarize, you lack maybe the necessary tools to measure that kind of impact due to the type of work that you're doing. Obviously, you're quite a technical, you know, institution, but being so, you're working within a particular mandate, which is a legislative mandate, which demands you to achieve certain things, objectives or goals on a yearly basis. And it demands that you measure that yourselves, whether in terms of your key performance areas you were able to achieve those or in terms of your key performance indicators, you managed to achieve the KPIs. So what I'm asking is, have you seen it important, for instance, that you begin to look at, you know, some of the indicators that can begin to help you measure the work that you are doing in order to satisfy the mandatory requirement, for instance? I don't know whether you understand my question, but that is the general question that I would like to ask you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair. My colleagues must answer anything that I slipped through, and if there's anything I don't specifically address, please remind me afterwards that I haven't, because there's a lot of questions. On the first question about cooperatives and the mandate of the CEE Competition Commission around unemployment, I think, you know, there isn't anything absolutely specific that a competition authority does around creating more cooperatives, you know, kind of boosting the cooperative movement. But insofar as a cooperative is a form of ownership, and a cooperative is a form of ownership, it's not, I think the one point that some people sometimes confuse is they think that a cooperative is firms getting together to collude. That's not the same thing. That's not the same as a cooperative. A cooperative is a, like you get a Peter Wye Limited company, you get a company owned in a particular way. And I think that we would see cooperatives in the economy as firms competing with other firms that might have different forms of ownership. And, you know, we would create, like we do for every other firm, the kind of playing field for a cooperative to be as competitive as a firm with another form of ownership. So I don't think there's anything particular we do around ensuring there are more cooperatives. What we would do is to ensure that if insofar as cooperatives already exist, they compete with other firms on a level playing field, okay, which goes to our kind of general mandate in a sense. The point I'm making is that we're not the policy instrument to be ensuring there's more cooperatives in this economy. So that's the question there. That's the answer to that question. Regarding what our most serious sanctions are, of course, any contravention of the Competition Act, we can fine a firm of up to 10% of its annual turnover, which is, if you've been looking at the numbers of firms we find in the recent past, you know, 6-7% comes to quite a sizable amount. In addition to that, insofar as if we identify a problem in a market as being a structural one, in other words, say one firm owns all of the blending plants in a particular sector, as has happened in the case of Sasol, for example, all the fertilizer plants that were owned by Sasol, we could make an order that the firm divests. In other words, it has to break itself up and sell off some of its operations. So divestiture is also part of the powers we have to cure a competition problem, which I think is also serious and something we wouldn't do very willy-nilly. It's something, you know, to ask somebody to break up a firm and kind of insist that a firm sells part of it to another player is a big thing. One has to be really sure and careful around doing that. It's not something that happens very often, but it does happen and it has happened. We have, in fact, used that power. So
how often have you used that, for instance, if the divestiture...
Well, most recently in Sasol, in the Sasol case, but we have used it, and I can't think of, we've used it in mergers. So in other words, when two firms are merging and in a particular market they have a very high concentration post-merger, we'll say they've got to sell part of that firm away, and mergers, I can't think of an example offhand, but we've done that, I don't know, 10 times at least I can remember in the past 5 years, or maybe more. So it's not something we do very rarely. I mean, we've done it often enough. Maybe Wendy can say something else about that later on. I think is the most drastic, in addition to the fine, the most drastic remedy we have. We can also declare anti-competitive contracts. We can nullify them. If you have a contract with somebody, it might be perfectly valid in contract law, but if its result is anti-competitive, you know, we could say that contract is hereby nullified, and that is the case. Of course, not we. We would make a recommendation that the tribunal make that decision, right? In terms of losing cases in court, you know, I think like every new piece of legislation all over the world is always challenged in the first instance. People want to create jurisprudence. They want to create a particular way of interpreting that law. And in South Africa. You'll get firms, businesses wanting to challenge the way we go about interpreting it, and we've had lots of challenges. And we have taken that in, this, in our stride with the understanding that this is a normal, natural thing to happen with new laws. And we have, you know, we've kind of stood our ground and fought for our particular interpretation of the law. If you look at the cases, for example, that have gone up to the Constitutional Court, those are the cases, you know, all of those cases, in fact, we won in the first instance before the tribunal. Then when those cases were appealed to either the Competition Appeal Court or the Supreme Court of Appeal, we lost them. But we didn't kind of just sit back and accept that. We appealed those decisions right up to the Constitutional Court, which is the cases I'm now talking about and whose decisions are to come out in the next few months. So, you know, so losing, sometimes you lose a case and you'll say, okay, there's a point there, you know, it's difficult for us to counter that point, we accept it. But in very important instances like the ones I'm referring to now, we have challenged us losing, having lost the case. And we will, you know, and that you do on a case-by-case basis. So South African law is still developing its jurisprudence. We have, I think, for a new law, you know, about 10, 12 years old, we have accumulated a substantial amount of jurisprudence considering how new this law is. You know, other countries with equivalent periods of time have not done so, mostly because we the more cases you have, the better your chance of developing the jurisprudence. So companies, you know, countries sitting with a new law but no cases for the last 10 years, they would have developed no jurisprudence. So that's the answer to that. And then, you know, are mergers such a bad thing? The answer is clearly no. I mean, clearly the fact that, you know, 98% of all our mergers just get approved without a problem means that in terms of the criteria we use in assessing whether a merger is a good or bad thing, in 98% of the cases, they're not a bad thing. And you're absolutely right. In many instances, mergers create efficiencies, economies of scale that are good for consumers, that produce new products, cheaper products, greater innovation, people putting their heads together, right? So, you know, mergers by definition are not necessarily a bad thing, but when they're bad, they're bad. And I think that, you know, the list I gave you very interestingly, and it's very unfortunate that most of the discussion that we've had in our society around mergers have been around what weight do you give the public interest in deciding. Most of those mergers I put up on the slide, none of them have anything to do with the public interest. They're all bad mergers in competition law. And they're all bad mergers in terms of competition, in terms of innovation, in terms of concentration of ownership. Those are all competition issues. And we, something only becomes kind of sexy and newsworthy when it kind of interacts with the public interest. But, you know, I must insist that prohibiting a merger on competition grounds is in and of itself in the public interest. It's not like, you know, competition grounds is something funny and then there's the public interest. To prohibit a merger on the public interest is in the public interest in and of itself. So all these mergers, none of them are public interest mergers. They're all mergers that are bad in competition law. I mean, a very interesting one is like Pioneer Hybrid and Panar Seed, which we prohibited. It went to the tribunal backed us up and prohibited it. Now they're taking that merger on appeal to the Competition Appeal Court. This is a merger that's bad in competition law. This is a merger that will result in, from South Africa, having three seed manufacturers, three companies providing seeds to farmers, will end up having two companies, both of which are American companies. So the number, in a market where three companies provide seeds to farmers, and these are maize seeds, our staple food, three companies. Number two is buying off number three. Number one and two are American. Number three is South African. You're going to end up with two American companies controlling who supplies seed in South Africa. Now, that is a big, serious competition issue, and nothing can be more, you know, against the public interest than something like that. All of these mergers are there are problems of them on competition grounds. So that's that. Are mergers a bad thing? Yes, that's the answer to that. Okay, so there's an interesting question. Why is our caseload increasing? What's happening? I mean, I think there's a number of reasons for that. You know, I think firstly, it's a very difficult one because, like, the better kind of analogy is like in countries where people deal with corruption more effectively, you end up feeling, well, that society is more corrupt. But that's not the case, you know. I mean, of course, you know, it might just be that they're dealing with it more effectively. In a country where you don't hear about corruption, there probably is more corruption than in a country where you hear more about it, you know. And so you've got to kind of just be a bit balanced about why you kind of see this as a problem. So I think there's a lot of issues here. One is, I think there is a high prevalence of this behavior in our society that's kind of historically determined. We come from a history of, you know, very kind of incestuous relationship between business and government, and the old government handouts being given to people. Government kind of, we come from a period of where there was greater government involvement in the economy than in the current period of the world over. You know, currently, it just so happened like that 1994 occurred right slap bang in the middle of when the whole world was liberalizing its economies, and that's something we've kind of inherited in policy, but a lot of the old relationships, the old boys clubs, still remain. The old, you know, people who knew each other and kind of, I think that's one of the factors we need to take into account. But I also think we're seeing more of it because we are an effective enforcer. We are an effective institution that are catching people out. And one of the very important things that makes us so is the fact that we've got a corporate leniency policy that is just the biggest winner we've ever had. In other words, what our corporate leniency policy does is it says that if people are colluding, the first guy who comes and tells us about it through the door, we'll give them leniency. We won't prosecute them, but we'll catch the rest of that cartel. That has proved to be a very effective mechanism in catching people out. Sure, you know, it sticks in the throat that one of them is going to get off scot-free. But if you compare that situation to not having known at all, it's better off, you know, if there's five members of a cartel, you break the cartel, one person gets scot-free, four of them get prosecuted, and the cartel doesn't exist anymore, which is far more important if you look at going forward. You've kind of disrupted all the people don't trust each other. There's no, those old relationships are disrupted and no longer able to maintain the cartel going forward. I think that's an important factor in why we've also seen more of cases in the recent past. So I don't think, you know, anybody concluding, for example, is the level, anybody saying that the level of cartel activity has increased in the recent past, I wouldn't accept that. That's wrong. I think we are finding out, we are exposing more cartels in the recent past is the more accurate thing to be saying, rather than they've increased in the recent past. I think they've existed for a longer time. The question around whether is advocacy working, I think my view, and my view is that it is. I think that it's hard to kind of, I think that, you know, it is something that we kind of now are ready to do some very serious research around. We couldn't do it earlier because there was too short a time lag between when we started and when you could see effects. But I think that, in my view, that I think there would be, it would be rare to find a boardroom in this country that doesn't think about or talk about the competition authorities and their implications. Certainly, I get that anecdotally from people who tell me that that's happening more and more. I think that enforcement is a very, very important part of advocacy. In other words, when people can see that other people get caught, they pay attention. If they think they're never going to get caught, they won't pay attention. But the fact that you kind of be successful, advocacy is not just about moral suasion. You've got to have the stick in one hand and the moral suasion in the other. Without the stick, people, without the threat of being caught, people will not kind of change, I think, their behaviors. And I think that, you know, a very good indicator about whether advocacy is working or not is the extent to which law firms in this country are opening up compliance units. So law firms are not only kind of getting firms coming then to help them defend the case, they're now getting firms coming and saying, look, help us put in place a compliance program so we don't get caught in the first instance. And if you look at the kind of in the recent past, how many law firms are expanding their compliance program parts of their business, I think that's a good indicator that advocacy is working to some extent, at least, or quite significantly. The very, very interesting questions around health is important. I think here, what happens in South Africa is, as I kind of started saying earlier, is in the early to mid 90s, there was the kind of wave of liberalization in markets throughout the world, and South Africa wasn't immune from that. And policy decisions were taken in the late 90s around liberalizing markets. That is what the decision was with respect to healthcare. The decision was to liberalize them. In other words, there's no longer government deciding on prices. There's no longer price determination under the auspices of some policy structure run by government. While that happened in policy terms and on paper, all of the old relationships once again continued, and all of these industry associations, so all the practitioners on the one hand and all the hospitals on the other, continued to set prices like they'd done before in a kind of collective bargaining sort of way. So you'll get the hospitals, the practitioners, and the medical aides all sitting around and negotiating collectively what the different prices would be. This was, for a competition authority, what we call kind of low-hanging fruit. You know, this was like straight down the line textbook collusion. Everybody's getting together. It would be different if government was overseeing that process, because then it would be policy. So what happened is our liberalization process replaced public regulation with private regulation, and private regulation equals collusion. Right? You can't have people privately regulating themselves without government having a hand in it. And that's what happened here. And it was kind of low-hanging fruit for us. We prosecuted them. They had to admit it. It was just, they didn't even kind of contest this. But what got left in the wake of all of this was a complete vacuum around the policy structure that governed all of this. And the fact that you had some of these players being so powerful in these, like if you've got two hospital groups, they have so much of power in these negotiating fora or negotiating with others that they're able to sometimes abuse that. And I think that this is what the Minister of Health is now going to address through, and it is about competition, but far more importantly, what it is about is it's about what is the policy paradigm within which this healthcare is going to function going forward. And those are very big questions. Sorry. Thank you. Okay, I'll be very quick. Sorry.
Please, if you can just use a minute or so to finalize.
So we often hear firms who we find saying, well, because you find us, we're going to, you know, people are going to lose their jobs, or we're going to, people are, there's kind of the feeling that they've passed on fines to their consumers. We don't think that is a sustainable argument. We don't think that happens. Okay, and I can explain in great detail why that doesn't happen, that that is just not true, that a fine gets in the accounting that's done, basically, a fine doesn't get spread over all of the, you know, doesn't get borne by the consumers in the end. You know, capacity management, do we have enough? I mean, you know, we kind of work with what we got. It's important that we can always have more. One of the problems we do face right now is a very mundane thing of office space, you know, like our biggest capacity constraint. We've got budget to increase our staff, but we can't increase the number of staff we have because we don't have office space to put them in. That's like a very practical problem we're facing right now around that. So, you know, that's we're going to have to explain that. Budgeting issues, I don't know the figures, but certainly we do kind of report on our kind of profile of our staff in terms of race, gender, and disability. Maybe Mahindran might want to say something like that. And we certainly do employ graduates from previously disadvantaged universities. And then finally, exemptions. I'm not sure if I answered the question of healthcare, but you tell me. You know, the final thing just to say about firms saying the anti-competitive nature of bigger businesses and being liquidated in construction, I'll answer that if at the next round of questions.
Yeah, it's already, I don't know how many questions are you left with, because I've given you more than 20 minutes to respond. You had referred something to your colleague to respond to.
I just wanted to add on the question that asked what are the most serious sanctions that can be imposed. With the Amendment Act coming into play, there's going to be an additional dimension of criminalization of cartel conduct. That's not within the jurisdiction of the competition authorities, but once that act is the effective date is pronounced, that will be an additional deterrent measure that will come into play. I mean, we've talked previously about some of the problems we see with criminalization coming into play, but I think we do need to take into account that something has been put in place to address deterrence of cartels in that respect. And then there was also the question about advocacy working. I wanted to add one of the other stakeholders in respect of which we see, you know, the impact of our advocacy interventions being legislators and regulators. We have some proactive engagements coming direct from you know, people who are contemplating passing laws or regulators in their sphere of work coming to us and saying, if we implement particular things, is it going to be problematic, etc. So there's a whole lot more consultation happening, which to us says we are making an impact, because even those who are responsible for ensuring that laws that they pass don't result in contraventions of the Competition Act are taking our work into account. I think that's it.
Thank you very much. I guess, members, the responses are done, unless you want to stay here another 30 minutes. Member Sodesi, I wanted to close. I wanted to summarize.
Yes, I just want to clarify my question that I wasn't saying maybe Competition Commission should slow down to not cap the, you know, something like retrenchment. I was just saying a company is not using that against you, because whatever you're doing is in our favor, but it does, you know, protect the consumers to a large extent. So I was just asking if they don't do that in order to scare you.
Thank you for that clarity. Obviously, finding out, exposing cartels and all that is not enough. What is important is what happens to the damage created already, especially with the prices that end up affecting the consumers. I think it is very important because it's one of your mandatory area to ensure that you provide consumers with competitive prices and product choices. So we will continue to be asking those types of questions until we are sure that there's something that is done to our satisfaction to that regard. I just want to come in and say something that is not conventional to the work of this committee, but I am going to be doing today or saying it. After, I don't want people after this meeting to come to me and say, "Why did you leave this hanging?" I want to perhaps begin to say we must really, when we talk, watch what we say. Mr. Ramboroth, when you talked of populist pressure, you know, referring to the issue of Walmart, you did get, you're saying you got populist pressure. If people oppose to your decisions, doesn't mean they have less regard to the work that you're doing. It might be that the decisions you are taking or the decision you have taken at that particular time does not favor their expectations or the expectations of the stakeholders or even constituencies that they work with. So I don't think that we should demean their actions following the action you've taken to that level. I think we must desist from that so that we don't end up offending anyone in the process. I was just going to say that so that it is not continued. Otherwise, we would like to thank you very much, and as we indicated before, that we will continue to support you. I know that you raised issues around the issues, the work that you are doing, especially against certain measures that you feel you need support on, and we need to be elevating or bringing out those types of work that you are doing. And it's a challenge to all of us to help you in ensuring that what you are doing, you know, receive the help that you can, for instance, for as long as it's for the benefit of the people. This is something that we must look into, and would request you to, where members don't or feel that they don't have sufficient information, that they contact you, and that they are able, through their motions, through their statements in Parliament or questions, they are able to recognize commend the work that you are doing, and even expose further to the public the issues you are dealing with. That's what we commit, and we've always committed to helping you. There are instances where we're not going to agree with you. That doesn't mean we don't appreciate the work you are doing, but it's mainly because we are acting in the interest of the people that put us in these positions. Thank you very much to your team. To Mr. Saul Levin for supporting you as the people you're working with. And I think this interaction sort of exposes him to issues that he must deal with at the departmental level on a daily basis. Members and the media, thank you very much for your attendance. We really appreciate it. We will meet on Thursday. Can I hand over to the secretary, Noel Thando, just to give us announcements in terms of where do we meet, where do we live, because those who are using the common transport that we will be using, so that you know what time must we be here and what time will we be leaving, what time are we starting with our stretch plan and so forth. We're having a committee meeting wherein we've on Thursday morning at 9:30, we will be considering the department's strategic plan. So because of time constraints, we had to use the strategic planning workshop venue for the meeting with the department on Thursday. So please make sure that we are there so that you can understand the work that the department has planned for us for this year. Noel Thando, can you clarify the logistics around traveling and the setting times, the program, when are members going to get their packages, because we were supposed to get our packages by now. Yes. So that's the things that we need, so that members, when they get there, they already have all those things. We finalize all the packages, what is needed for what, the work is in your hands now.
Honorable members, as for the preparations for the workshop, our accommodation has been booked already in the Arabella Hotel and Spa in Hermanus. We've got ground, we've got transport to take members from Cape Town to Hermanus, but what is short now is for members to confirm their addresses, where they want to be picked up tomorrow, so that we can confirm the times with the transport people. As for the packages, we were making documents, packages for the member files of documents that are going to be used in the workshop. But now we've got a challenge. The committee assistant just sent me an SMS to say that our photocopy machines are now faulty and they are waiting for the technician who's going to come after 1 o'clock to come and fix the machines. She was halfway with the documentation, but now the machines broke. The workshop will be starting at 9:30 on Thursday. Each day it will be starting at 9:30. What else?
The itinerary for what will be happening is it part of the package?
It's part of the package. Yeah, the itinerary is part of the package and the programs and everything. But we'll be contacting the honorable members to confirm everything.
Okay, there you are. Please indicate where you need to be fetched, and but it would help if it's a central place for all of us, and we need direction from yourself, as I indicated to you. Yeah. Otherwise, members, thank you. Oh, you have a question?
Yeah, just to check whether the committee section has booked the flights, because to confirm where you don't know where you're flying, and are there any bookings done?
Regarding flight bookings, we were also requesting information from the honorable members of where they will be flying from and tomorrow and two on the 24th, we will book flights for the members.
He's indicating that they might be full, so make yeah, make it quicker. Otherwise, they might have a challenge of getting spaces in those flats. Thank you very much, members. We will meet on Thursday. Thank you.